Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following presentation features Dr. Lolo Hong, the Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs at the University of Hawaii at Hilo. She has dedicated her life to advancing education, improving the health of communities, and promoting social justice. During the Roots of Change conference in Portland, Oregon, she discusses why it's important to include the involvement, ownership, and leadership of men in primary prevention work.
So I wanted to start first with why work with men. And I've started here sometimes going, okay, well, this should be obvious. But as I've talked more with colleagues and with friends and family and people that I'm working with on these issues, I find that it isn't always something that we can just assume. So first of all, we know from countless research, personal experiences, observation, negative impacts of violence affect the quality of life for men, women, and children. So for so long, we have focused, I think, on the very specific and narrow impact, predominantly on looking at just women and children, I think, for a large part. We need to recognize and acknowledge that men themselves are also the victims of violence in both direct and indirect ways. We also know intuitively that the positive outcomes of a world that is safe and free of violence benefits men, women, and children. I'm acutely aware of this working on a university campus, where we know that the experience of violence, the fear of violence, becomes one of the most common reasons why our students may leave their college education or interrupt it. And so we understand that this is one of those necessities. And so when we have a society that embraces the dignity of all and gives them a chance to realize their full potential, that really is a gift, and I think we can all strive for that. And then finally, because sexual violence is gendered behavior, its primary prevention requires the involvement, ownership, and leadership of boys and men. I want to share with you a concept that is forwarded by Chimamanda Adichie. She is a Nigerian author. Some of you may have read some of her recent works. She talks about the danger of a single story. And I want to use this. For those of you familiar with critical race theory or have heard of master narrative, this is somewhat similar, but not exactly the same. So the single story, Chimamanda reminds us, is the natural tendency for human beings to rely on a story to define reality. She also talks about the impact of power, and power can be defined as the ability to tell the story of another person and to designate that story as the definitive story of that person or that group of people. So that's a form of power. She further reminds us that single stories may be true, but they are incomplete. And so if you think of stereotypes, stereotypes are really an example of one story of a person or a group of people. And so they may or may not be true, and even if there's a slight truth, the problem is if we rely on just that one story, that one stereotype to define the person or group of people, we're doing so at great risk. She further goes on to clarify that where the story begins is important. So for example, if we talk about the discovery of the United States, of the Americas, and start the story with the landing of Columbus on the continent, versus starting the story with the complex and highly sophisticated culture created by Native Americans, you get a very different version of reality and of truth. Those in power can control which story is told and also suppress others. So there's the story that gets told, the master narrative, and the other stories are the counter narratives. Those who have a vested interest in the master narrative will work very hard to make sure those remain silenced. The work of social change, the work of eradicating oppression, and in this case, the argument I'm going to make, the work of reducing and preventing sexual violence, requires that multiple stories be told and heard. So I'm going to come back to this concept of the single story over and over. When we talk about why work with men, I want to hone this down just a little bit. The goals of engaging men, and I've adapted this from some of the work of Michael Flood, who's a scholar in this area, is first of all, we want to have men's communities as an opportunity to deconstruct male and white privilege and other forms of privilege, whether it be around sexual identity, class, education, etc. We want to also closely examine the intersections of identity, integration around them, rather than fragmentation. Often, for our students, what we found is that we flatten the story of identity. So you have to pick one. And increasingly, what we're finding, for example, in our admissions applications, is students cross out all the other things that we've checkmarked, and then they mark other, and then they put in their own thing. And so we're really seeing that the traditional ways in which we have thought about identity and tried to pass those on to our young people is no longer relevant. And I think it's important that we look at that as practitioners and scholars, and how can we move towards integration of the multiple identities with which we are each comprised, and then also create multiple stories. We want to engage in work that reconstructs manhood as nonviolent, and there are several sessions in this conference that are going to look at that more closely. Actually, I thought it was actually really interesting. All of these goals that I'm talking about, if you look in the conference program, there's something in there that will help you further expand on and examine each of these areas. It also is a venue to expand the number of stories about gender, about sexuality, about relationships. So, for example, one of the things I get often questioned is my view on pornography. And so I've always felt firmly that the way to solve pornography is not to censor it, but to create avenues in which we can create other stories which challenge or contradict or add richness to the story that's told in pornography. What's problematic in pornography isn't the story that's told in and of itself. It's that becomes the only story about men, about women, about sexuality, or about how people relate to each other. And that is one aspect of how we do relate to each other that is beautiful and is something that we need to accept and acknowledge. But the problem is when we rely on that one. So we want to create an opportunity to tell more stories. To borrow the term from Alan Berkowitz, we want to teach how to do consent. And this is much, much, much more complex than the no means no. Because what we also know is no means no is one story. We also know that there are times when the words yes do in fact not mean yes, and sometimes the words no don't actually mean no. And that's a complexity to our human communication that sometimes is very challenging for us to acknowledge. And I know when I've said those things that people have reacted and that might push a button for them. But talking about consent is a very extended conversation, so we need a safe space to do that. The creating a men's group is also leveraging what we know about what it is to be in a men's community and the challenges as well as opportunities that creates. So in a men's organization or men's community, we want to make sure that we redirect masculine bonding, male socialization, and men's culture, not towards celebrating and creating and reinforcing a single story about masculinity, but how can men provide true emotional, intimate support to each other as they do the work to understand who they are and become part of the solution and not just bystanders. Men's groups are a place where we can also address men's victimization towards each other, the experiences that they've had at the hands of their fathers and other male adult figures, and also by women in their lives. And then finally, it's an opportunity to empower boys and men to be agents of social change. So this is a deep, rich, complex, difficult agenda, and when you look at that, no wonder so many of us never begin, because looking at that list is just simply exhausting. And when you look at that, so much of that seems so difficult and so impossible to do, because so often what it is we don't have the imagination to see what might that look like. We live in a world where the single stories don't tell these stories, so we have to help create imaginary stories in the meantime until we actually find the reality. And these realities are existing in pockets all over the world. I also want to talk about what I think working with men should not be. Now, I want to preface this that this is just Lolo's own perspective, and so certainly open to challenge and dialogue on this. But this is informed by sort of my own personal experiences and observations in doing this work. So the first thing that men's work should not be is simply transferring the existing curriculum and workshops and strategies that we've already had to male messengers and teachers. And I've seen this a lot happen, is campuses, for example, will take a men's group, create a men's group, and take the workshops they've been created by largely female students that have been, for the most part, done and implemented with female audiences, and just simply flop that over and said, let's have some male students give this, and voila, here we go, we have a men's program. So it's not that simple. We need to make sure that we avoid the traps of creating curriculum or pedagogy that's culturally irrelevant. Educationally ineffective or potentially alienating. And so I've seen efforts to work with male students that actually has in some way either done no benefit or in some cases created further barriers to positive change. Men's work should also be focused on the systemic level as well as individual attitudes, behavior, and knowledge. We are so predisposed as a society, I think, to focus on individual attributes. If you think about it, the dominant hegemonic culture of the United States is very much focused on individualism, rugged individualism. That's what built this country, is rugged individualism. And that focus on that, even the medical perspective, which is one that we privilege, is about individual health choices and individual change and how individuals can do things differently. And if that individual just hadn't done X, they wouldn't end up with Y. So we're very much focused on that autonomous, non-connected way of cause and effect, if you will. And so it's important that we don't fall into that trap as we work with our men. So we want to focus on individual as well as systemic and group. We also want to be careful that we don't replace one single story of masculinity with another single story. So that's the danger, right? And so we have to be very mindful of that. And I know I've had to catch myself and be mindful and be critically mindful of myself, making sure that I'm not just creating another one-story solution. So it's important that we focus on multiple stories as we move towards a transformed view of masculinity. And then lastly, this is really important. The work with men cannot be performed by men or women who have not unpacked their own baggage. So the power of socialization is tremendous, and I think every day I'm reminded how much we easily underestimate that power. This is a lifelong work in progress, and I still am humbled by how often I am in my own lifelong work and still unpacking my bags, if you will. And so there are times where sometimes I question, geez, should I be doing this work, and reminding myself, well, it's incremental change as well. And so one of the dangers that I have found is just because you're male, doesn't mean you're the right person to do the work with men. And just because we're women and have a special type of knowledge from our informed experiences doesn't mean that we're necessarily the right people to be doing this work. No matter how, and this is true, I guess, in all kinds of different venues. Now, it doesn't mean that there isn't other kinds of work that we cannot engage in, but that the work of working particularly with young men and boys around violence prevention and redefining masculinity is something that's important when you go into that, because you're deconstructing, analyzing, being critical, trying to create insight. If you haven't gone through that personal process yet, it becomes difficult to be a facilitator of that type of work. Okay, so before you freak out over this slide, okay? So as someone told me, that was just way too many words. What this is Bobby Harrow's cycle of socialization. How many of you have seen this? Okay, if you this is what I would call Bobby's way of talking about sources of single stories. And this is that unpacking the baggage. It's just acknowledging that we start, if you look at what would be on your left, our initial socialization, is this is how we come to learn the stories of different people and groups of people as we grow up. And so Bobby is known for her work in oppression education, oppression reduction work. And so she talks about the experiences we have when we are born, that we are clean slates. We have no stories about anyone or anything. But then as we grow from early childhood, the socialization begins. As we enter the school system and start interfacing with broader society, there's institutional and cultural socialization through the education system, through churches, through legal system, healthcare, industry, businesses, corporations, media, language, music, all of those things. And then as we grow up and continue in our adult life, there's constant reinforcement of those stories. There are sanctions, we're stigmatized, we see who gets privileged, who does not, who's persecuted, who is not, where does discrimination take place, who feels empowered. And those experiences then serve to reinforce what we've already seen in terms of stories that people may have. And so I want us to think about this and overlay it with how we teach boys about what it means to be men. And I want to also remind us, how do we teach girls about what it is for boys to become men? That's critical. And then vice versa. How do we teach girls to become women? And I'm using these words as constructed identities, not as absolutes. These are what we construct for others. And then simultaneously, how do we teach boys about what it means to be a woman? So people are hearing stories about themselves and the groups with which they identify, as well as the stories of other constructed identities that may not be identities that they claim for themselves. And then Bobby goes on to talk about what's the impact of these stories, that we grow up feeling guilt, stress. We may resort to violence. We internalize the stories that we hear. We might feel silenced, anger, a dissonance, because something in us in our gut says, this is not quite right, but we're not quite sure what to do with it. We may feel dehumanized as a result of what it is that we're socialized to believe. And so these are all the inner feelings that we're going to develop. And then we face that moment of truth. What are we going to do with those feelings? And so we have actions and choices to either do nothing or do something. And so later on this afternoon, the follow-up session I'm going to do, the breakout, is going to talk about the cycle of liberation, which one could argue is essential towards any successful movement of change. So Bobby talks about that this whole cycle of socialization creates for so many of us a core of fear, ignorance, confusion, insecurity, that which we may or may not be in touch with or be able to name. And it is this core that we have to unpack before we can become effective advocates and educators and implementers, if you will, of effective violence prevention work. I just want to take a few brief moments to talk about my personal story, because I think when I look back and think of what was the journey that led me to where I am today in terms of how I think about the issues of violence and think about the issues of gender, it's always, for me, just humbling to think about there were key moments in my time. The other thing that I've also learned, in Hawaii, there is a very treasured and time-honored tradition of talk story. Now, obviously, they're not the only community that honors the talk story tradition. But what I love about the talk story tradition is that it's about taking the time to know those with whom you work. And the idea is that when you know with whom you work, it's much easier to forgive those moments when they do push your buttons, or when they say something where you go, huh? And you want to immediately disagree, you're more likely to give the other person the benefit of the doubt when you know who they are and you know from whence they come. And I think I first learned the value of knowing each other's stories when I first moved from the East Coast to Louisiana. How many of you grew up on the East Coast? Okay, all right. So I will own the fact that I will speak about the East Coast from my own personal perspective. I find the East Coast to be very fast, very harried, and not focused on the talk story tradition, okay? So when I first moved to Louisiana, the feedback that I got early on in the first 6 months from my very beloved mentor was, Hong, you need to slow down. You Yankees just think you just come on in here and you're going 80 miles an hour, but people don't feel like you like them. I said, what are you talking about? I love everyone here. Everyone's so nice. And so my mentor said, because you sit right down and you just get right down to business. People need to know that you care about them as people. So before you start jumping into the budget and the figures and the what are we going to do and what we're trying to accomplish in your fancy strategic plans, that's really how my mentor spoke. I love him. But he said you need to take the time to get to know them and let them know you. And so you don't know who I am, and I'm going to try to do a little bit of that who I am so you understand why I sort of came to these conclusions. So as you heard, I'm going to back up the story, right? Because where you begin the story is also important. I am the daughter of immigrants. My first language was not English. I grew up speaking Taiwanese and Mandarin Chinese in the home. I'm the oldest of three. And so up until probably about five, when I entered the school system, that was my dominant language. We don't have extended family here in the United States, so my primary family affiliation was really my immediate family. I led a very sheltered childhood, a very, very traditional Chinese upbringing. My parents were extremely protective. My mother barely got her high school diploma, and her ticket out was to have an arranged marriage where she could experience socially upward mobility. And because my father was going to immigrate to the United States and get an education, for my mother's family, that was seen as a chance for her to really better her life. So she came to this country with high hopes for her children, and when she had daughters, what she told me was it was important for them to have the chance to do the kinds of things that she didn't have an opportunity to have, that we could have choices in a way that she could not. So I worked very diligently to do all that I could to get into the best colleges. As my parents told me, they moved to Connecticut specifically so I could get into Yale. No pressure, okay? So I didn't get into Yale. So that was a huge disappointment for my family. But I did end up going to a very small private liberal arts college at the very young age of 17, extremely naive and not knowing who at all I was. Had no sense of identity, no sense of me, no sense of self, and no sense really of what I wanted. I just knew what my family wanted of me. So I go to college, and this is pre-date rape, acquaintance rape awareness, right? So many of you here in this room know what I'm talking about. This is before the Katie Royfe story that was on the Time magazine. It was before those terms were really talked about. And so my freshman year in college, I was a rape victim. And so I was followed home from a party by an acquaintance who proceeded to lock himself with me in my residence hall room and sexually assaulted me 3 times that night. He got up the next morning, tousled my hair, gave me a kiss on the cheek, and said, "Thanks, I had a great time, baby. I need to go to church." I had no words to describe what had happened to me. All I knew is I had done something really, really bad. I could never tell my parents, and I was extremely ashamed. I felt extremely dirty. I talked to the person I was, my partner at the time, who was, we were in a long-distance relationship, my high school sweetheart, and shared the story and said, you know, this was this horrible thing that happened. And he accused me of being unfaithful and promptly broke up with me on the phone, and we did not talk again for several months. I finished out the school year, but was extremely depressed and knew enough that there was something wrong with me that I felt that it would be important for me to go see a mental health counselor. Now, the next thing that's going to come out of my mouth, I want you to understand, is a single story about one counselor. It is not a story about the entire mental health profession. Okay, so I want to say that. The particular counselor who I happened to speak with, I think, was very well intentioned, but she was informed by one story about Asian American women. What she said to me was, after doing my family intake, "I think you need to stop hurting yourself by rebelling against your family through your sexuality." So we didn't go back to her. So I went into myself. I went home for the summer, worked hard to save money for my next year's college, but I was not whole. I went back for my sophomore year. I got a job as a peer health educator, which ended up being my saving grace. And I made, I struggled. I was drinking a lot, not taking care of myself, and I did make a suicide attempt, which obviously was not successful, but in my sophomore year. This ended when my mentor and supervisor gave me a book called I Never Called It Rape. A lot of you know that. I have 5 copies, okay, of that book. Now, as I've gotten older, I have my own critique of Robin Warshaw's work, but that is another session and not for today. Okay, I digress. I think the point of the book is I finally had a way to talk about my experience, and there I was. Hi, my name is Lola Hong, and I'm a rape survivor. Because in that book were the stories that were just like mine. So I had this chance to understand that my experience was not my fault. Now, it takes a little longer. I'm kind of shortening the story, right? The immediate thing was like, oh, you can imagine my feelings, right? So I was angry. I was upset. I cut off all my hair. I had hair down to my waist. I cut it all off. I became this radical. I had gone from someone who never said boo to someone who was have found my voice suddenly. And the voice was informed by anger. I was really angry my junior and senior year. But I turned that anger to create a self-help support group for survivors of sexual assault. I spoke at the first Take Back the Night march. I wrote articles in the student newspaper. I incorporated education about sexual assault awareness in some of the workshops I did on campus. I talked about the role of alcohol and other drugs. So it was very healing. It was an important part of my growth that I needed to go through to name the experience and start to bring integrate that experience into who I was. So I'm going to fast forward. I look back and I realize one never ever is glad that they're a survivor. But at some point you get to a place where you go, you know what, there are some wonderful things that happen. And one of the things I think that did happen that I'm so grateful is it led me to public health. So I chose my program. My mom wanted me to be first a doctor. When I decided I fainted at the sight of blood, that was out. Then she wanted me a lawyer. Yeah, that didn't appeal to me. Then she said business person, right? Those are the three triumvirate of appropriate Chinese professions, okay? So all three were out for me, and I decided to pick education. And it was absolutely the right choice. My mother never forgave me. Well, she did forgive me eventually, but we didn't talk for about a year. Eventually, she realized that this was my life's calling. But I chose education, public health, because I thought this is an experience I don't want to have happen to other college students. In graduate school, I got counseling. That was so key. I got counseling that was supportive and affirming and really helped me to name my baggage and start to unpack it. Finished up my graduate degree and take me to Louisiana State University, where I became a woman. That's what I grew up there. And there I had the chance to work with this amazing group of young men. And what you see here is the executive officers from 97 to 90. I have their photo because they were the subject of my doctoral dissertation. This group was a group from which I learned as much as I hope I had opportunities to provide learning for, if you will. What this organization taught me was exactly that importance, that we have to involve everyone in this effort. And when it struck home for me was after I was in a very serious car accident. My car was absolutely total, and it was one of those new cars. Toyota had that collapse technology, if you all know what that is. It's when it hits, the metal is designed to crumple so that it takes up the impact of the crash instead of the car not giving and your body takes it. So I walked away from that with some minor injuries, but had back problems, which I'd never had before. So a lot of time off from work, you had to deal with the legal stuff. So I'm doing physical therapy, and I break out in tears. And why am I crying? You know, I'm doing this physical therapy. And it hit me that I was tired of being a victim and being the one to have to do all the work to fix it. Right? So I was pissed off. I was like, you know, first of all, the guy who hit me didn't have insurance, so my insurance was covering it. And then I'm the one doing the physical therapy. They walked away because they had like an 86 Chevy that was built like a dinosaur. And my car was like this, and their truck was just sitting there. So it was really interesting for me to connect that experience. And from that moment, what I realized was, wow, this is a fascinating society where what we do is make you the victim and then you responsible for cleaning it up. So we've really done an amazing work. Talk about a story that we've sold. And so it dawned on me that I was working with hundreds and thousands of colleagues who were themselves, many of them had experienced victimization and were the most passionate, amazing contributors to the movement to create change. But I didn't see any of the people around me who are the individuals responsible for creating the victimization. So that's when I had this light bulb go off. And then I went back to my roots of public health to remind me that in the end, the most cost-effective strategy we have to make change is primary prevention, right? Condom, I was a sexual health educator, a condom is a lot less expensive than a lifelong treatment of antiviral drugs. Right? So in terms of HIV prevention, pregnancy prevention, I mean, same concept, right? If you are not interested in starting a family now, use of a birth control method way more effective than, okay, so this concept of prevention was really key and I got it in other areas, but somehow not linked it in the area of violence prevention. So that was my aha moment. And Men Against Violence helped me to understand that further because what they did was challenge a story that I had, which was that men don't care. They challenged that story for me because each of these men, each of the 60 men that I worked with that charter year, they were all men who cared. Now, they may not have understood how to make a difference, a positive difference, but they all cared. And that was very important to have that other story about men. So let's talk about some new stories. So first one, reacting keeps us distracted. This is really an important story for me that I figured out, okay? So this is the prevention model that we just talked about. So the first box, tertiary prevention. This is really where most of us hang out, even on colleges, okay? I look at the mission statement, for example, for our women's center, okay? Our women's center mission talks about the prevention of this and the promotion of a society without sexism and racism and, we talk about all those things. But the vast, overwhelming majority of time when I looked at the reports of that unit, what it talked about was the number of sexual assault and domestic violence victims that we served. And that's good. That's important. I mean, it's not good. We shouldn't have that many. But it's valuable. It's important that we're doing that work. But what I was struggling with is we were saying that the mission of the center was X, but the work was still not X. Does that make sense? Okay? And so we were hanging out in tertiary prevention, even though we said we were doing primary. And so I thought about all the ways in which we do that is we're distracted by, and they keep limited resources in the area of sexual assault response. So we never have enough time, human, physical, or otherwise, to get to the primary prevention. I mean, think about that. That's pretty darn powerful. So we can create the illusion of funding and opportunities to do primary prevention work, but the reality of it is you can never quite get there. It's really hard to get to that work, right? Because the crises you have to respond to. Okay, so then secondary prevention, then you rise to primary prevention, which, as Emily reminded us, it's measures which stop or reduce the possibility of violent events from occurring in the first place and do so across large portions of the community. So I want to remember is that the work of intervention is absolutely essential. We have to keep doing that until the agenda of prevention is successful. But we also want to be mindfully aware of how we become tools to serve the hegemonic interests, right? It's really beneficial if we get stuck there doing that crisis intervention work, because we never get to where it really is going to make a fundamental, foundational interest. So that's one story. This is another way to kind of slice that. Opportunity cost of sexual violence, Emily Buchwald has written, the fear of sexual assault that is part of the daily life of women in this country takes up a continent of psychic space. A rape culture is a culture of intimidation. It keeps women afraid of being attacked, and so it keeps women confined in the range of their behavior. That fear makes a woman censor her behavior, her speech, her way of dressing, her actions. It undermines her confidence in her ability to be independent. The necessity to be mindful of one's behavior at all times is far more than annoying. Women's lives are unnecessarily constricted. And as a society, this one issue hampers the best efforts of half our population. It costs us heavily in lost initiative and in emotional energy stolen from other, more creative thoughts. Now, we can add the same concept of opportunity cost to men who are trying to become part of the men's movement to end violence against women, is that we also create a culture of intimidation so that it keeps men confined in the range of their behaviors. Men need to keep acting like men. And when you start challenging what it means to be a man in this society, you're violating rule number one of manhood. Or as Jackson Katz says, you're stepping outside of the man box. And so there's all kinds of punishments for men who don't do that. And so again, what we're doing is it costs us heavily in the lost initiative of men and in the emotional energy stolen from other more creative thoughts and work that men can be doing as well. Another new story, another story that I want us to think about. The questions define the answers. And this is a concept that I think most of us understand intuitively, but I want to make it much more explicit. The questions you ask define and limit the answers you receive. So I'll give you an example. On campuses and in many task forces for states and counties and communities, a task force gets convened, right? And think of the question that oftentimes gets asked. How do we make sure that fewer women are victims of domestic violence? Right? That's the question we usually ask. I want us to think about how it would be different if we said, let's get together a task force or campus planning committee and say, how can we reduce the number of people who are perpetrators of domestic violence? Do you see the difference? It's a small one, but we oftentimes don't ask that. I want us to think about the healthy 2010 that the Centers for Disease Control creates. All of those goals are written from the perspective of reduction of victimization when it comes to violence. Not perpetration, victimization. So the problem is the victims. Now, that we have victims is problematic, but I'd like to think the problems are the perpetrators. So why couldn't we say that by the year 2010, which is next year, hello, we would like to reduce the incidence of perpetration among college men from blah, blah, blah to blah, 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 right? That's a different story, right? If you ask different questions, you get different answers. Deciding which questions get asked is a form of power. Who sets the agenda for the meeting? Doesn't it ever aggravate you? Why didn't we talk about blah, blah, blah at the meeting? Well, who set the agenda? You set the agenda for the meeting. You get to define what is considered a problem, and you get to define what gets airtime and what gets talked about. Similarly, our assumptions, our fears, our hopes, our paradigms and worldviews, those all dictate the questions we are likely to ask or have the courage to ask. So that becomes really important, who we put in the position of setting the agenda. I will confess to you that I'm not actually particularly enamored of being a vice chancellor for student affairs. I don't like how public it is. I don't like how everything is my problem. I don't like I'm dealing with crises all the time. I don't even feel like I get to spend as much time with students as I would like to. And that's why I work in student affairs, because I love students. And the student contact is what has juiced me up and kept me motivated. But why I have sought reluctantly the role of leadership is I always complained about those people that were in power and how they set the agenda, and they didn't put the questions that I felt were the questions that should be on the agenda. And so I thought, well, let's stop complaining and do what I need to get into that position where I can help set the agenda. So that's why I'm there. I'm there so I hope I can responsibly take what I have brought with me through my life experience and professional journey and make sure that I don't let my assumptions, fears, hopes, paradigms, and worldviews limit the questions that I ask and set an agenda which is broad. And here's also my favorite new story. When the solutions aren't working, you probably need to reframe the problem. Or another way to say this is, insanity is doing the same thing and wondering why you don't get different results. So if you look at the data on sexual violence, it's largely been pretty consistent. Most of us on our campuses don't see a huge amount of shift, and we roll out the same workshops and the same talks and the same seminars and the same orientation program. We're doing the same things. They aren't necessarily creating meaningful change, measurable change. So here's a new story. Maybe we need to change the questions that we're asking so we result in different answers. And so I'm going to give you here a way to look at this. These are proximate causes of violence, and this is where we hang out a lot in our intervention efforts. We talk about the socialization experiences of perpetrators and victims, their individual attitudes and beliefs. We talk about individual characteristics of the perpetrator, adherence to rape myths, power, control. There's all kinds of measures around how they feel about dominance, et cetera. We might talk about interpersonal and situational dynamics. What's the relationship between the victim and perpetrator? Where was the assault located? All these contextual pieces. And there's some interesting research about perpetrators' misinterpretation of victim intent. So how does alcohol, that's my favorite. It's so often we make alcohol and other drug use intervention as almost like a substitute. Like if we just dealt with the alcohol and drugs on our campus, there'd be less violence. As if the only people who perpetrate violence are intoxicated or high, and as if, you know, it's not a person, it's a human being that's perpetrating the violence. And then other nonverbal cues, that type. So this is all good stuff. We want to talk about this, and we do hang out here, okay? But which is really different than an agenda that looks at the root causes of violence. And again, Emmeline kind of talked about these at the beginning, that it's part of a continuum of behaviors that begins with subtle violations, that we're socialized from childhood to accept and be indifferent to violence through cultural beliefs, societal norms, corporate practices, and institutional policies. That violence needs to be deconstructed and named as gender behavior and as a reflection of systemic practices. And then finally, that it's inseparably interrelated with issues of social injustice, as has been mentioned, it actually forms the foundation for a broader system of oppression, power, and privilege. And it's not difficult to look back in time that the history of marginalized versus privileged groups, that almost always violence is a tool, or at least the threat of violence is a tool, to keep people in their place. So the new story that we're trying to tell, and I cannot repeat this enough, and even to a group like this, is how often we also forget, and I'm working every day with folks that we need to remind ourselves that violence is gendered. Violence is gendered. Violence is gendered. Males comprise the overwhelming proportion of perpetrators of all forms of interpersonal violence. Males also comprise a significant proportion of the victims of non-sexual violence, a story we don't tell very often because it's inconsistent, right? Because men are supposed to be strong and be able to take a little more violence, sometimes the violence directed at men is seen as less serious than the violence directed at girls and women. Violence by boys and men is used to affirm prevailing norms of masculinity. And cultural beliefs about masculinity, as well as homophobia, heterosexism, et cetera, serve to normalize men's violence. It's one of the ways that we keep men acting as men. I'm going to breeze through this because most of you probably have at least a core understanding of gender. I think one of the ways that I think is important to just remember is that it's a socially constructed status. And sort of similar to Emily's reminder that we need to not engage in binary definitions, I'd also like us to, whether you think of a system as multiple or binary, is to remember that gender in the end is still a socially constructed identity, right? It's something we've created. It's a figment of our minds. It doesn't have to be a way that we classify each other at all, okay? And in fact, what's interesting is in part of the Native Hawaiian culture is a recognition of the fact that gender is almost obliterated, you know, that there are people who are, you know, male, female, or, and it's not even about transgender or anything like that. It's just the concept that gender has a very different perception. It's constructed very differently in that culture. And so it's not biological or physiological. It shifts across time, place, and context. I think that's very critical. And this gender socialization begins early in childhood, which is why I always want to say boys and men, not just waiting until college, which for us is oftentimes not too late, but harder to do because it's more baggage to unpack. Let's see. And then deconstructing masculinity, this is really the work that I focused on. It's just looking at the ways in which research has looked at how masculinity interfaces with violence. One of the things I want to talk about is all-male social groups, which is the third one down, that there is a lot of research to show, and I think a lot of our intuitive experience and lived experience will remind us that men in all-male social groups, that tends to exacerbate hypermasculinity or adherence to stereotypical norms of masculinity, because one story of masculinity gets told in that group and reinforced. This is what oftentimes supports people's fears about all men's organizations. Okay, so I just wanted to raise that. It makes sense. There's a reason why our gut is having that experience. But then I want to end on the last one, which is metamorphosis. And this is, again, where I focus on my research is that we can see that there's starting to be a shift, that there is a way in which men can successfully start to counter that. And a reminder that constructions of identity are only that. They're constructions of what's expected. It isn't a statement of how all men actually are. Right? We all live with men and boys in our lives who don't at all adhere to the stereotypical norms of masculinity, but they might feel the pressure of it. Okay? I'm kind of blitzing through this because I realize a lot of you come with an understanding of gender. Okay. The other news story that I think is really important, I want to share. I'm reading Laurel Hamilton, the Nita Blake series. Anyone? Okay, no one's looking at me with like recognition. Okay, so I'm a fantasy genre reader, and for some reason, vampires really fascinate me right now. Okay, so Anita Blaker is a vampire hunter, and this is a story about her. So interesting female icon, interesting representation of her as power. But in the book, the one that I'm reading right now, there is an incident in which a former partner of hers is allegedly falsely accused of sexual assault. She brings in an attorney, and the attorney says to her friend, this is not going to be easy to defend, but it's going to be easier because you're handsome and you're white. Okay? So I just want to name that, and that is, you know, for us, we go, okay, I want to not respond to that because I want to not believe that that's something that we still think today in 2009. But the reality of it is that we still have some unfinished work around issues of racism and sexism. And so I want to borrow from Angela Davis, who really challenges us to remember, how do we develop analyses and organizing strategies against violence against women that acknowledge the race of gender and the gender of race? Right, so that we don't live in a world where being white is a way to defend that you weren't guilty. Okay, and so, in other words, I just, very subtle, but that happened in that book because that was a story that would resonate with readers, right? It rang, oh, okay, yeah, I get that. So that's problematic. Where does that come from? So how do we, and this is really difficult because this has to do with the intersection of identity. In each of us, because of our multiple sections of identity, simultaneously have identities which are privileged and simultaneously identities which are marginalized. And the fascinating thing in our society is, because we tend to be people who might not like to take responsibility because that's daunting, is we run to the place where we're disprivileged, where we're not privileged. to the place where everyone's, well, I don't understand this whole diversity oppression stuff because I'm not privileged. I'm poor. Disputing the fact that I might also be white and male, which are privileged identities. You get where I'm going? Okay. And this is one challenge I have with my white female colleagues in women's studies departments, where it's really difficult to engage in that conversation about their privileges as white people, even though their experience of marginalization is women. So that's what we're talking about here, is both and. And so the challenge I have as a woman of color speaking with my male men of color colleagues to help them see that they can go to the place of being men of color and focus on the ways in which they're oppressed because of their race or ethnicity, but holding them accountable for understanding how they're privileged as men. So that's what Angela's talking here, acknowledging the race of gender and the gender of race. And so we must learn how to oppose the racist fixation on men of color as perpetrators at the same time that we acknowledge that there is real hurt that they are perpetrating against women of color in their own communities, but also the system is biased against them. Okay, so the quote from Angela Davis, we must also learn how to oppose the racist fixation on people of color as the primary perpetrators of violence, including domestic and sexual violence, and at the same time, fiercely challenge the real violence that men of color inflict on women. So this is just, I think, emphasizing the point that there is the intersectionality of identities. Let me talk a little bit about the news story now on another layer. And that's, let's invoke the master narrative concept, right? The idea that there's this story to explain human phenomena and human behavior. And that there are stories about sexual violence that really resonate with the way that we think about it, talk about it, and analyze how violence happens in our lives. So one example is we privilege the legal perspective, right? The law, and oftentimes for young people, when I teach in my women's studies courses, this is how young people think about rape and sexual assault and domestic violence, because that's their primary interface, is the law, how the law defines it. So here's what happens is we ask things like, was there penetration? Is there proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Is the perpetrator guilty or innocent according to the court of law? Was there consent? And some of you are going, yeah, so what's wrong with those questions, right? And so what I want to remind us is that that's one type of story, one lens that we can lay down to deconstruct and understand how it is that sexual assault happens. So it's really important that we work with girls and boys and young men and young women to look at how this is only one way to analyze sexual assault. Here's another one, the medical perspective. Okay, I picked these two perspectives because they're very dominant and very held up as elite, if you will, in our culture. So in privileging them, were there visible bruises? Right, that's how we think about violence. Were there bruises? Was semen present? Are the post-trauma symptoms consistent or typical or normal? Right, something like that, as complex as human reaction to trauma. Well, is that typical? Is that usual? So, I mean, I really applaud Burgess and Holstrom for their work on rape trauma syndrome, but what we all know is everyone experiences, you know, trauma in very different ways. So, again, think how powerful this is. And when I talk with my students, they're like, wow, this is how we think about these things. And then I want to add another perspective that is the story that gets told. We privilege the media perspective, okay? And so we have to remember what the goal of media is. I mean, I have people who still believe that if you read it in the paper, it's true, okay? Or I saw it on the news. I mean, it must be true. So we privilege that, and this is what we have to teach, how to be critical to consumers of media. The goal in media, pure and simple, is not to report the truth. It's to raise ratings and generate revenue, right? So you have to match the story, the single story or whatever story it is that your sponsor wants to have or that people in your community want to watch. So that's going to skew your story. So we have to ask ourselves, and whose story is missing? So I remember in class working with students when the Duke case was happening, where the lacrosse football players were accused of sexual assault. And all students had as their primary source was the news. And they talked about the case, about what did or didn't happen, based on the news, like they were there. So we have to help our students be critical consumers of media to understand that the perspective that's being put out there, whose story is missing, okay? Then technology exacerbates the single story, Because what do we do? Is Facebook of a friend picks up a story on one source, right? So that one source now gets proliferated to all your friends. Then your friends proliferate it to their friends. And news story in one site is then pulled by another site. And so it's the same story proliferated over and over and over and over and over again. And what it looks like is multiple news stories, but it's actually still the same one. So it's still one story. Okay, so these are important ways to look at stories and can be a part of how it is that we talk with our young men. And then here's another news story, and I know that this is something that Men Can Stop Rape works on a lot. This is that sources of strength vary for both men and women. So how do we talk about what is strong? Favorite quote from Lao Tzu. In this world, there is nothing softer or thinner than water. But to compel the hard and unyielding, it has no equal. That the weak overcomes the strong, that the hard gives way to the gentle, this everyone knows, yet no one asks accordingly. So this is just another way of talking about strength. And I think this is one of the most important pieces of dialogue that I have found we have to work with when we talk with young men, because the fear is, well, I need to be strong. Men are supposed to be strong. And the reaction is not another single story, which is, no, men don't have to be strong. The reaction is, yes, men can be strong, and women can be strong, and men don't have to be strong always, and men don't always have to be strong in this way. So that's what adds to the complexity and to the richness. And then I think conversely is the other side of the story in deconstructing that norm is to also talk about the story how people who aren't men also can be strong. So I think that's the other piece when we deconstruct masculinity we have to talk about is non-masculinity can also be strong. I want to close by talking about, as we finish up here, the conditions for success in working with a men's group. This is, again, just Hong's perspective. So I want us to think about the stories that we just kind of talked about, the danger of the single story, and that men's groups become a way to talk about what are new stories or other stories or multiple stories that we can add, so it creates that richness. So it's a tool for that. So conditions for success, if you're thinking about doing this work, first of all is you need to have the self-awareness. We talked about unpacking your bags. What are the things that push your button? Where are the areas do you feel that you've done a lot of introspective work? Where do you feel you have a lot more personal life experience that you can share? And then finding colleagues and partners and other individuals who can help shore up those other areas where maybe you don't have as well-defined a self-awareness. The other thing that's important is credibility and trust before accountability. Now, this is true even for men working with boys, okay? Because there's a generational difference. If there's a difference in terms of racial identity or class identity, educational status, all of these things, all kinds of barriers to establishing rapport. And so it's important that we understand that before you go in holding others accountable for what they're thinking or how they're thinking is wrong, quote unquote, you have to understand that you take the time to talk story. Let them know who you are. You find out what their stories are. Find out their humanity first so that what they're spewing out doesn't just become the right thing or the wrong thing that they should be saying. So credibility and trust before accountability. And that was definitely a major part of the journey that I had with Men Against Violence. One of the moments that I was most proud of, which, you know, when you deconstruct it from a feminist perspective is kind of interesting, but go with me here, was when the members of Men Against Violence at one point said, oh, Lolo, we don't think of you as a woman. You're just Lolo. And so I thought, okay, that's really interesting because they had gotten to the point where they just let it all hang out. They were uncensoring what it is that they were saying. So I thought really interesting that I have to be de-womanized to be, you know, to that place. So that's why I think that's a little bit interesting, but that is not the content of today's presentation. The point was you got to get to that place before you can start to then challenge and hold accountable. Courage and patience. This is really hard and scary work. It also doesn't happen overnight. You cannot simply undo 20 plus years of socialization that is reinforced. One of the things we have to remember is Men Against Violence was one place that boys and men could be. But they weren't with Men Against Violence all of the time. And when they left LSU, they weren't with Men Against Violence anymore. And they spent the first 18 years of their life certainly not with a group like Men Against Violence. So it takes a lot of courage and patience and a movement. And that's why it has to be everyone involved in terms of engaging that process. And so if you're going to do this, you have to know that you're someone that doesn't need quick results, right? If you're a quick results person, It's going to be hard work here. Okay, and if you're someone who I'm not sure that I want to put myself out there. It's going to be there's other work than that maybe that is better for you to do, but this one is definitely one that raises a lot of fears and anxieties. Cultural competence and cultural fluency. There is a culture to working with, particularly young men. So even if you're a man, okay, and so we talk about this oftentimes, the generational differences, to be relevant as a teacher, you have to be able to speak that language, understand that culture, and know what's relevant. Here's a great example. The concept of rape is a crime of power, okay, right? Everyone understands what I'm saying. Rape is a crime of power. So when I first said that to the first time at one of our Men Against Violence retreats, the young men were looking at me like, what? We don't understand what you're saying. Can you explain that? So I'm trying to explain it and use all my best metaphors and all that. And so what they said to me is they said, Doc, we're not sure we're getting where you're coming from, because in our world, in their heterosexist world, women have all the power. I was like, huh, come again? And so they said, first you have to ask them out. So, have you ever done that, Lolo? That's a pain in the butt, because they now hang out in groups. So you got to step to not just the one you think like you want to go with. You got to step in front of her and all her friends. So then if she turns you down, it's like you look like a loser in front of five women, not just her, five women now. And then they text each other and they email each other. So like the whole world knows. So I'm like, okay. So they were like this whole, and it really resonated. One of them said that, and they all resonated. Yeah, you're right. That is just so, that asking someone out is really fearful. And then when you go on the date, they're in control. Cause you're thinking about, where does she want to eat? What movie does she want to go? What does she want to do? And I said, well, why does it matter so much? They said, well, because you don't know if you're going to get busy that night unless she's happy with what you did. I said, so your end goal when you know where this is going. So the end goal, we try to name that. And so we finish out the whole story. And so lesson number one is, I didn't let my buttons get pushed, because, right, this is challenging the story that I'm thinking is where we want to shift to. But the reality is that was a story. And I had to be open to understanding that in their world at 18, that was a form of power. So we acknowledged that, okay, and then we shifted and I said, okay, and can we talk about power in a different way? Let's talk about physical power. Can you all understand? So we talked about that, examples in which, when we play intramurals, guys bigger than me, blah, blah, blah. So then we use that. So I'm not going to belabor the whole point, but you have to have that cultural competency to accept that there are other conceptions of power, other ways of talking, and that's just one example. Here's the other one that's probably key. We need to go into this work with a mindset of education versus activism. Now, what do I mean? And I mean this as spoken as someone who's been both an educator and an activist. When you're an activist, change needs to happen yesterday. You start off knowing that where we are now is not acceptable and it must change. And it goes with it a set of rules for how to engage. When you're an educator, you start where the learner is. You first understand where the learner is, and then you develop a learning intervention that brings the learner in as a partner in that learning, and then helps create educational insights together. And in that process, hopefully you are influenced and shaped as well. The mindset of education helps create courage and patience. And so I want to say that there is a place if you are an activist, and there's a place to do activism as men, but that's different than working with the men's group to help educate and create new norms of masculinity and new and different understandings about violence and power and identity and privilege and oppression. Right, because that's educative and developmental work. And so this is a really key piece, is that if that you have that activist approach, pick another venue, right? This really is an educative work. And this is really key, because then in the end, to tie it all together, you need a sustained network of social support for boys and men committed to this work over the long haul. There are so many barriers to resolve. We need people to buy in. There's suspicion about men's programs. What role do women have in those programs? We need to address bystander behavior. I'm not violent, so why do I need to get involved? All the people I know are not violent, so why do we have to have this program? The historical belief that boys will be boys, which still exists in 2009. The problem sometimes if you hang out with colleagues who think like you is you forget that there are colleagues out there who don't think like you. That's a danger I always catch myself on. fear of the feminist agenda, right? I mean, I've still had that name. Oh, men's groups are just another hidden way for feminists, quote unquote, and all that, you know, the incorrect assumptions that go with that, to emasculate men, etc. Homophobia in all male peer support networks is really important. In fact, that's one of the things that Men Against Violence had to address first before they could even get to the work of violence against women. Keeping the focus on men's behavior and privilege rather than on women's choices and vulnerability. Right? Men Against Violence at first wanted to get together and do workshops for the sorority so they could tell those women how not to do blah, blah, blah so they wouldn't get raped where they were. And so redirecting to men's behavior, men's privilege. Developing a curriculum which doesn't reproduce or rely on traditional stories of masculinity. You have to be very careful when you talk about real men don't rape, because you're creating another single story. Maintaining hope and resilience, and then allocating limited resources. I still, to this day, believe that an effective men's program actually costs much less in money. What it takes is your time. So I don't think it drains off resources from other programs that we need. So I want to close with this quote from Rebecca Walker, which really talks about the story. We all have stories, and we have a collective story. We have a story that's embedded in our memories, and that in a way to move past that and get to a world in which there is much less violence and hopefully no violence, we have to in some ways take that memory out, chew it up, spit it back out, and put it someplace and pack it away so we can create rooms for new ones. Rebecca says, "It seems to me that this too is how memory works. What we remember of what was done to us shapes our view, molds us, sets our stance. But what we remember is past. It no longer exists, and yet we hold on to it, live by it, surrender so much control to it. What do we become when we put down the scripts written by history and memory? When each person before us can be seen free of the cultural or personal narrative we've inherited or devised, when we ourselves can taste that freedom." And so what we have before us is the work in creating men's group is, again, remembering, keep your eye on the prize. It's not creating men's group just simply so that men can be part of the movement. It's to do this very deliberate work, to dump that memory, if you will, to let that go and create new ones, to not live in a place of what has been and what is, but create a place of what ought to be and what could be. As Martin Luther King has reminded us, freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. And then one of my favorite ones as an educator, Henry David Thoreau, "It takes two people to speak the truth, one to speak and another to hear." I wish you all of the best as you continue your journeys to share multiple stories, create a rich matrix of stories, a weave, if you will, and continue to find courage and patience.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission, or to show your support, visit CalCASA.org. That's CalCASA.org.